To keep, that he was presenting one, try to keep it or something?
Good morning, everyone. My pleasure to invite you to this meeting of the House Committee on Higher Education and Workforce Development. It's Monday, February 25th, 2013. We have two very, very interesting topics for consideration today. The first is the whole area of STEM, and the second is going to be an attempt at making college more affordable called Pay It Forward. So let's start with STEM. I'm going to open an informational hearing on STEM, and I'm going to call up Representative Harker and Senator Steiner Hayward to talk to us about the work of the STEM work group task force.
Special committee. Good morning, committee. Chair Dembrough and everyone else, thanks so much for having us here. And I will say, Chair Dembrough, that I'm almost used to these 8 a.m. starts on Monday morning, but I do hold you responsible. So, colleagues, every one of us brings into this building our experience, and some of you know this about me, some of you do not. What I did before coming here, and for much of the time that I've been here, was basically STEM. I had a STEM life. You know, I was a biologist kid, very interested in biology. I became a biological researcher up on the Hill, which I'm told we should no longer call the Hill, but at OHSU, and I was there for a number of years running a laboratory and a clinical support lab, and to support researchers like the MD sitting beside me. And I got seduced away from that academic career by an idea I had, which turned into a software business for other researchers and then for research institutions. As such, I learned a great deal about the power of STEM education, if you will, when combined with other things. I was thus very happily assigned to the STEM task force during the interim, along with Senator Steiner Hayward and our Senator Girard and former colleague Representative Lindsay and many of the other people that you're going to meet here today. We were charged with looking at the state of STEM education in this state and access to it and success of delivering it. And we came up with a report which was presented to this committee and the House Ed Committee last December, when some of you were around, but not all of you. So we're doing it again very briefly before we get on to the bill that comes before you as a result of the task force report. I'm going to read you just a couple of sentences which come from the report, which I believe you all have in PDF format. From the executive summary, Oregon's role in the global economy is defined by its citizens' flexibility to respond to an ever-changing employment climate. Being competitive in the global markets means that citizens are literate in the sciences, technology, engineering, mathematics, the STEM disciplines. And since we're supposed to not use any undefined acronyms, I guess I should say that STEM is science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. And I also realize at this point that I did not introduce myself for the record, which is what I normally do down here. I am Chris Harker from House District 34, which is Beaverton and Cedar Mill. Going back to my reading, the OEIB has made pursuit of career and technical certification and post-secondary degrees a priority of its 40-40-20 plan. Similarly, the Oregon Workforce Investment Board, or OWIB, Manufacturing Workforce Committee, has identified inadequate STEM knowledge and skills as one of their four priority challenge areas. So what we are trying to do here is address a couple of things, critical things, such as the unemployment rate in this state and the graduation rates of high school and completion of certificates in community colleges and within the university systems in disciplines that will enable people to apply for the jobs, which are here and available in pretty good number, but that we are unable to fill as an employer that I used to be and as some of these people behind me are and who will tell you such. We think that we have put into the report some suggestions which will help address that problem and those challenges. I'm going to touch on them very briefly, and then the senator will say a few words before we move into the bill. We are proposing, after much discussion from people who are ranging from faculty to high school students to leaders of industry, that we come up with a STEM council that would operate under the chief education officer, currently Dr. Rudy Crew, and that council would advise and select places for investment of some resources which we would pony up and others might well pony up in matching funds or matching time. We would like to create STEM hubs around the state. 4 to 7 of them are what were envisioned by the group. And these would act to coordinate, as Rev. Johnson and I were talking about earlier today, the situations where we've got an employer, such as Google, such as Facebook, who greatly understand the needs of for the type of employees that they're looking for and are willing to work with the school districts to help produce those employees. So to coordinate teachers, students, parents, outside of school groups, and some commercial entities such as Google and the others that I named and many unnamed. Hubs would, we think, go a long way towards coordinating those things. We also recognize that it would be very helpful to do some infrastructure improvements around the state that would enable us to deliver, some of these courses and instructional materials online to areas of the state where we don't really have the physical presence of some of these companies and the teachers don't necessarily have the expertise to teach all of these disciplines. We also recognize that the appreciation in the private sector of what the schools are up against is very great, and they are willing to step up in all different manners. Facebook recently, I think just last week, donated $130,000, if I recall correctly, dollars to the high school and the city, the county, Crook County, to help with STEM education. We need to leverage with some state funds and some state structure the willingness of the private sector to help solve the problems that the school system is up against. I think I'll turn this over to you now to chime in a bit. And we have until 9 o'clock, so we're trying to move really quickly through this.
Thank you, Representative Parker. Senator, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, Mr. the Vice Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Elizabeth Steiner Hayward, and I'm the state senator from District 17, which includes House District 34 and House District 33, which is ably represented by Representative Greenlick. So you've got the whole triumvirate here today. It was my privilege to serve on the STEM Access Task Force along with Representative Harker, and really an extraordinarily diverse group of people from across the state, ranging from high school students, who one of them is here today, to people involved with technology, to outside of school activities, which are so important. To my mind, one of the most important things that we talked about was the importance of both vertical and horizontal integration when it comes to thinking about STEM education. And this is to say we should be starting with our youngest Oregonians to show them that math, science, technology, these are all parts of our day-to-day lives. And take that education, that foundation, that engagement all the way through to graduate work to prepare a diverse workforce for Oregon. That's the vertical piece of this. Now, one of the things I'd point out about that is that it's equally important that we prepare people for graduate work as it is that we prepare them for the trades. I have industry in my district in Northwest Portland that employs 850 people who are involved primarily with the trades, welders, electricians, machinists, building barges and rail cars that go all over this country and serve the entire area well in terms of transporting goods. And yet they have to train their welders for 6 weeks in the classroom before they can even start to get them out on the floor. Another industry right across the river in Senator Shields' district needed to bring in welders from Alabama. Now we've got unemployed Oregonians here. This is an economic development issue for our state. So as we think about this, we have to be thinking about every single kind of STEM education that we can. The horizontal integration piece Representative Harker already referred to, and that means engaging not only our traditional early childhood through graduate education model, but also outside of school activities, industry, and pretty much anybody who understands the importance of engaging in this kind of education. We know that students who are exposed to math very early, who understand how it plays a part in our day-to-day lives, are much more likely to succeed in school and to really enjoy this. We know that kids who aren't destined for a four-year college degree are more likely to stay in school if they're exposed to the kinds of trade things that we know that they may go into and find productive careers. As a physician, I'm really concerned about the healthcare workforce in this state. We've got an aging population. Those of us who are baby boomers, which is pretty much all of us sitting here, really have to think carefully about where are we going to get our health care from as we get older? Who's going to provide for us? And the answer is we don't have nearly enough health care workers in this state, no matter what we do, unless we do a much better job of growing our own. So the proposals that you have before you today and that you'll hear much more about from other members of our task force really talk about both the vertical and the horizontal integration, the need for this to develop a robust, sustainable economy in Oregon, and to think about how we make education relevant for all Oregonians. I thank you very much for inviting me to speak with you today. I thank Representative Harker for inviting me to join him. And I thank the members of the task force for their extraordinary work. And I'd be remiss if I didn't mention Channa Newell, who staffed our task force and really kept all of us on track, was instrumental in helping set up meetings, which with this diverse group was challenging, helping us write a report and make sure we stayed together. So thank you all for your consideration of this bill. I apologize for my having to leave. I have to go chair a committee of my own. But thank you very much.
Okay. Before you leave, Senator, colleagues, anybody have any difficult questions to ask of the Senator before she leaves?
Bring him on. The representative.
Okay. We'll focus on Representative Harker.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Senator.
Thanks.
Thank you. Yeah. Good to see you.
Anybody have any questions for Rep. Harker?
Yes, Chair. I just had one question. The hubs you mentioned, is there a location for those yet, or are you thinking of?
Chair Dembro, Rep. Gallegos, thanks for the question. We didn't feel it was our job on the task force to select the locations. There are a number of locations come to mind. There are some groups from whom you will hear a bit today who are putting together coalitions that would qualify very nicely for being one of them. And we will see how that shakes out over time.
Thank you.
Rep. Huffman and Rep. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Rep. Harker, as you were, the group was looking at current infrastructure that's in place, the work from Bruce Schaefer and the engineering group that's already in place. Do we have a group that's already in place instead of setting up another council that are already working on STEM initiatives that could do this, or why did you determine it was necessary to set up another council?
Chair Dembro, Vice Chair Huffman. We did not feel that while there is certainly their ETIC is oriented along some of the same lines that we envision these councils, the council as fulfilling. It is not charged with looking at the full spectrum of education that we're looking at now under Governor Kitzhaber's and Dr. Cruz's new structure. We did not feel that there was a coordinating body that would be able to advise in a cohesive and informed manner the people who are making decisions about policy. So we thought that a council would probably be the best way to go about that.
Follow up?
Let me say one more thing, too, which is that when we get into the bill, there will be more discussion about the council. But please continue.
Maybe a reversal of that. Do you envision the council being comprehensive enough that I'm going to get shot for this, but maybe take over ETIC, or ETIC would be under the council, since there are related industry perspectives.
Chair Dembro, Vice Chair Huffman, they certainly are related, and such a thing could happen if the decisions were made by people above my pay grade.
Right, Leah, let me jump in that we'll be hearing from Eric Meslow from ETIC later on, so we can give him a hard time. Thank you. Rep. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative, for being here. I really appreciate the work.
I had to be here anyway.
Yeah. And actually, this is a red letter day because Rep. Gilliam actually was here before today. I don't know how that occurred.
Rep. Gilliam has been here before you the last three meetings.
Thanks for keeping score, Mr. Chair.
He's counting.
But he's been sleeping over here.
Yeah, right. He's sleeping in his office. I appreciate your reference to not simply investing in people, but investing in infrastructure, because I think that's one of the areas that we sometimes forget is sorely lacking as we try to provide quality STEM education. Certain schools or school districts have that capability. Other school districts sadly don't. So I'm glad that you're addressing that, or at least raising that possibility. So, again, we'll talk about the bill more as we go on, I'm sure, but in terms of the actual dollars and so forth that are going to be available for this investment, do you see the state making targeted, OEIB, I guess, with making targeted investments in this fund that could then be leveraged with other private sector money? Could you maybe, what's in your mind as you think about this?
Okay, Chair Dembro, Rep. Johnson. Yes, I definitely envision the state putting some money into this, and I would consider those to be some of the most highly leveraged dollars that we could spend as a state in terms of the education that we could provide to kids all over the state with the infrastructural improvements, as you just mentioned. But over time, the lives impacted by this type of education and the dollars earned would get us a long way towards raising our median income above the average of the country, as instead of being below it where we are now. And the bill does ask for an investment up front. We know it's a big ask, but we believe that it would pay off several fold if we are able to do this.
Good. Thank you very much.
Okay. Rick Gorsuch, quickly.
Oh, yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. In my district, there's been some discussion about the adding back in some of the school districts, things related to STEM. Is this connected to that, or is that a separate piece?
Chair Dembro, Rep. Gorsuch, this could very well be connected to it. We are not trying to focus purely on technology for IT specific projects or employers. We think, as the senator mentioned before she departed for the other committee, that this type of education plays out in careers that did not used to require this type of training at all, but certainly do now. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you very much, Rep. Parker. And let me just say, colleagues, that those of you who are new to the committee may not know that the task force was created is a creature of this committee, actually. Last session, we passed House Bill 4056, which created the task force. And, you know, there are task forces and there are task forces. There are some that, you know, that are created and do some pro forma work, and then the work gets put on a shelf and is forgotten. But, you know, I think you can see just, you know, in terms of the many people and partners who are here in this room, that this is one that I think really has the potential to go somewhere. And I thank you, Rep. Parker, for all the work that you did in making this, getting us to this point.
My pleasure, Chair Dembro. I greatly appreciated the assignment, and I appreciate your comments, too.
Thank you. Okay, call up the next panel.
I can do a very brief introduction following the administrator, if you like, and then I'll get out of the way and let the panel be here.
Okay. So I'll open up the hearing. So I'm going to close that informational hearing on the STEM task force.
Chair, why don't you invite the first panel up? I'll get up there and make any introductory comments, and
okay,
so we can expedite things.
Great. And I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2636. And our first panel is Jill Island and John Mullis, if you would come up. let me say that, you know, sitting here is sort of embodied what we were just talking about in terms of, you know, is STEM engineering, is STEM career technical education? Maybe it's both, right? And so I look forward to your comments, both of you.
Good morning. Thank you. I'm Jill Island, Corporate Affairs Manager for Intel Corporation and also co-chair of the Oregon STEM Employer Coalition, here representing one of the larger employers in Oregon, who's asking you to help us pass H. Bill 2636 to elevate STEM education in Oregon. We've worked closely with the task force and with various employers around the state of Oregon. We have about 60 members now of the Oregon STEM Coalition that are working with the legislature to try and get this bill considered seriously. I just wanted to tell you why a company like Intel cares about passage of this bill. Seated next to me is my building trades colleague, John Mollis, and he and his partners are helping us build the latest new development fabrication facility in Hillsboro, Oregon, D1X. And we have about 17,000 Intel employees now working full-time in Oregon and almost 17,000 contractors working in Oregon to help that factory be built. You can appreciate the skills that it takes not only to wield a hammer on the job site, but to help develop the next process technology inside of the factory, which is why we care not only about how this impacts employers in the private sector, but certainly those who are helping build the next generation of innovators. So the Oregon STEM Employer Coalition came together across all industries because we are the companies that need to compete through innovation. And our goal is relatively simple. We want to provide opportunities for students. And by 2025, we want to have doubled the number of fourth and eighth graders proficient in math and science. And we want to double the number of post-secondary graduates in the STEM degrees. We know that Oregon is failing to produce enough STEM graduates. Now, a company like Intel has about 1,000 graduates of Portland State working for us, about 800 Oregon State University graduates, and about 400 University of Oregon graduates, and several hundred graduates from Oregon Tech Institute. So we have a significant number of Oregonians who work for the company. And because we are a global company, we can recruit people from all over the world. But I do know that when we get down to the technicians in our factories, for example, we hired all 28 graduates of the Portland Community College microelectronics program the year before last. And so we can't get enough of those kind of students coming out of our system. So we believe very strongly that it's time to invest in STEM. We thank the committee and certainly Representatives Harker and Dembro for your leadership on this. And you're going to hear a little bit later this morning from a student at Hillsboro High School, Savannah Lohberger. So I'll just tell you that keep in mind that when you invest in STEM, what comes out the other side is an exemplary student like Savannah.
Good morning, Chair Dembro, members of the committee. My name is John Mollis. I'm the Executive Secretary for the Oregon State Building Trades Council, and I'm pleased to be here this morning to support House Bill 2636 to help move STEM education forward. I was pleased to participate in the two STEM conferences that were held last year. We in the building trades maybe take a little bit different view than Ms. Island and some of the other folks that you'll hear from later. We understand the need for more scientists and engineers, and we fully support those goals, but we also believe that the STEM classes that will be offered in the future can provide opportunities for students who might choose to become pipe fitters or electricians or sheet metal workers, or one of the highly skilled crafts that we train and represent. Our jointly trusted joint apprenticeship and training committees have over $35 million invested in training centers around the state. Most of them are in the Portland metropolitan area, but we also have them in Salem, Tangent, in Springfield, in Medford, in Coos Bay, and in Redmond. And these centers not only train our apprentices and provide continuing education to our journeymen and women, but we also have them open to the public for various events such as Veterans Days or the Women in Trades Fairs. We've hosted robotics competitions at some of them in the past. Currently, the Plumbers and Pipe Fitters Training Centers in Tualatin and Springfield have high school students in their centers during the day, part-time, is a cooperative relationship with some of their surrounding high schools. We would like to explore more of those type of collaborative efforts. I heard Representative Harker speak about the need for regional facilities. We'd love to be part of the conversation of how our centers could help be part of this. We view this as whether the students that get involved in STEM choose to design the next chip for Intel or the next generation of high tech, or become a construction engineer or architect and design the building that they hopefully need to expand, or if they choose to become one of the members, apprentices, and then members that we represent to build a building. To us, any of those scenarios are a win. So thanks for the opportunity to share a few words. I'll do my best to answer any questions you might have.
Thanks, John. Yes, Rip Grimmick.
Oh, I've been always concerned by the late age that people come to apprenticeships. A couple years back, it was like 25 years of age. And how are you guys doing on reaching back into the high schools and trying to capture kids before they get lost in high school?
Chair Dembro, Representative Greenlick, yes, we for many years have been concerned about that as well, and I think it not only affects students that kind of bounce around sometimes and aren't as productive in their early 20s in seeking a career as they possibly could be. But I think these STEM efforts tie directly into those. I also think the CTE bill that is being considered will help those efforts as well. I think you need to have these kind of opportunities available for students in high school and even in middle school so that they know those options for viable alternative careers are out there. Colleges are great, but I think everybody knows not everybody's going to college.
Thank you. Yes, thanks for that question. No, absolutely. And we will be, I think the week after next, we'll be hearing, we have several CTE bills, and we'll be looking at those. You know, I was just saying to someone on the drive-in this morning that one of the things I really appreciate about robotics teams, you know, if you look at the robotics competitions and the teams that are put together is, you know, so often those teams include, you know, they include the sort of more abstract nerdy types. If I can,
forgive me.
Forgive me, nerds out there.
Yes.
But then also people, you know, who are you know, tinkerers, who are, you know, just really good at making things. And, you know, they're all on the same team. And I think somehow that needs to be the vision for what we come up with here, where, you know, it's not, you know, competing initiatives, CTE versus STEM. I mean, you know, I think they're really, they're interlocking.
Chair,
yes, there you go.
I do have a question, more informational. I apologize. It's very exciting to learn about STEM. How do you? What's the scope of STEM? Is it mainly at high school where the major focus is, or you're talking about, you know, apprenticeship programs later on? So that it's sort of, what's the scope? Where do we focus on? And then the second part of that is, how do you do it? How do you connect with students and get them into the programs?
The goal that we have is twofold. So I would say it's the education continuum. The earlier we can get the students interested, the better. And Representative Dembro mentioned robotics. The first Lego League robotics statewide tournament was just held at Liberty High School in January. And we had about 450 middle schoolers competing in those programs from around the state. So, but the goals of the STEM Employer Coalition that support the bill that you're all working on are trying to make fourth graders and eighth graders, double the number of fourth graders and eighth graders proficient in math and science. But I think it starts much sooner than that. And so anything we can do to build a culture throughout the state of Oregon that encourages kids, whether they plan to go to college or not, to feel more comfortable with these subjects is a good thing. But the focus really is the education continuum, and I think it fits well into the education reform initiative that's moving through the state now that looks at the P20 continuum.
Great. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Both of you for being here today. Realizing that we have not yet introduced the bill. And so what is this thing we're talking about, this House Bill 2636? Victoria will let us know.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2636 creates STEM Investment Council charged with advancement of educational initiatives in fields of science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Establishes the STEM Investment Grant Program to fund programs and STEM investment account with monies for account appropriated from general fund and to council for purposes of awarding grants, declares an emergency effective July 1, 2013.
Yep. Thank you. Okay, with that, I'm going to call up a panel of practitioners, Todd Sanders, Lita Cullivan, and Bill Becker.
Mr. Chair, might I chime in for a minute?
Please.
To the question asked by Rep. Gallegos, there are efforts underway, programs in place in small and large school communities, districts all around this state, including such a thing as the Sisters Science Club, which is in Rep. Huffman's district. And they are trying, volunteers, working with teachers and the schools to try to get kids early on hooked on how cool science can be.
And that's for males as well. The Sisters Pro. Oh, it's Sisters of Town. I thought you meant. Okay.
Fellows, too.
Okay, thank you. Who's going first?
Jimmy.
Sure.
Okay. Todd. Welcome.
Good morning.
My colleague.
Debra and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Todd Sanders. I'm a career and technical education instructor at Portland Community College, and I'm a member of the Interim Task Force. Thank you for this opportunity to speak. House Bill 2636 is going to be an instrumental component of our state's educational plan, and I encourage members of the legislature to adopt it. Society is undergoing an incredible technological change, and with it is experiencing a growth in the demand of STEM professionals. At this time, the U.S. is losing some of its most knowledgeable technical workers to retirement, and as a result, Oregon industries are looking for more STEM workers and will be searching for more in the next decades. Community colleges will play a major role in addressing our STEM education needs today and in the future. In Oregon, over 60% of students who graduate from universities attend a community college first. Preparing STEM students for transfer is one way that community colleges will participate in the STEM educational pipeline. Community colleges also offer career and technical education programs. Career and technical education programs are directly advised by industry councils and tend to respond more rapidly to emerging industry demands. This is a fact I can personally attest to, and I can inform the committee that my colleagues are doing some amazing things today. There's an excitement and energy right now within the state's STEM-related career and technical education programs, and we are ready to tackle the challenges of STEM education, and we have ideas. Meeting the goals of an Oregon STEM education plan requires we increase the number of students transitioning from secondary to post-secondary education. Our state's dual credit program will play a big role in this increase. Agreements between community colleges and high schools award students with college credit earned while in high school. Not only does this eliminate redundancy in students' coursework, but with dual credit, students also get an economic incentive and a motivational incentive as well. We know that students who participate in the dual credit program are far more likely to attend college than those that do not. College completion is necessary for any STEM career, and community colleges provide the greatest opportunity for educating many of the first generation in college, low-income, and minority students. These underrepresented groups will provide a vast, untapped resource, and not only their inclusion, and only through their inclusion in the STEM pipeline, will Oregon have a realistic chance of meeting its STEM goals. Community colleges work. Our offerings range from high school completion programs to career technical education to university transfer, welfare to work programs, small business development, and customized workforce training. With a network of connections and partnerships throughout our district, Portland Community College is helping to lead the way in STEM education. We have begun to see collaboration develop a STEM hub in the Portland metropolitan area, while also developing a brick-and-mortar STEM center at our Southeast Portland campus. And we are currently completing a memorandum of understanding with the Portland Metro STEM Partnership to create change in the community through a collective impact approach. PCC is excited to continue to play a role in our STEM education and STEM workforce. We are a large, multifaceted, innovative college that is already committed to STEM. And a recent article in our Communities magazine highlights our STEM work, and the next 2 weeks will be mailed to over 350 households in the five-county area. And we've just emailed a copy to you this morning as well. PCC and myself will be actively engaged in the conversation about STEM education as it moves forward in Oregon. And I thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you very much, Ty.
Who's going to go next?
Chairman Dembro, Representative Harker, Representative Huffman, members of the committee. My name is William Becker. I'm the director of the Portland State University Center for Science Education. I was also a member of the Joint Task Force on STEM Access and Success. I'm here to provide testimony about the biggest challenge facing our state's science, technology, engineering, and mathematics education community, and to propose a strategy to answer this challenge in a manner that's designed to transform STEM teaching and learning cultures for all students. The recovery of Oregon's economy depends on the growth of businesses and industries that employ STEM workers. The Oregon Employment Department estimates that 40,000 new and replacement positions will become available in STEM businesses in the coming decade. This is a low estimate, as it does not include jobs in education, social science, or the healthcare community. Currently, the education system in our state is unable to meet current needs, never mind projected needs. Eco Northwest analyzed student achievement data from Oregon Department of Education and the National Student Clearinghouse. Only 923 students from Oregon's 2006 high school graduation class have earned a STEM undergraduate degree in the past 5 years. This is approximately 2% of the graduates from that class and half the national average. This means that if our education system does not increase at the rate at which STEM positions become available, Oregon will experience a 4-to-1 ratio in terms of the number of students, the number of openings of jobs, and the number of students prepared to fill those jobs. This will stifle economic growth and require business and industry to employ and import STEM workforce from other states and nations, a trend that already exists. I'm a 30-year resident of Oregon. I have a daughter and soon-to-be-born son who will be entering Oregon schools. I want my son and daughter to experience an education that will prepare them for the 21st century jobs in our states. Independent studies from the American Association for the Advancement of Sciences and the University of California, Los Angeles have shown the best predictor of student success in STEM degree programs is their level of attainment and achievement as students graduate from high school. This trend is even more pronounced if you look at traditionally underrepresented STEM students. These students are also the fastest growing subpopulation in our state. This means that STEM success is not only a social, not only an economic issue, it's also a social justice issue. If Oregon is to meet the growing workforce needs in our state, we must do a better job of graduating high school students with knowledge, skills, and dispositions to succeed in STEM degree programs. We must also retain them in post-secondary certificate and degree programs and award them credentials that qualify them for Oregon jobs in STEM careers. Educating our students for STEM jobs in Oregon is a systemic challenge. I urge you to consider House Bill 2636 as an initial investment to bring about a systemic solution to this problem. At the beginning of the testimony, I stated that I was the director of the PSU Center for Science Education. I am also the acting executive director of the Portland Metro STEM Partnership. This partnership is a prototype of the STEM hub that is identified in the task force report as an agent that will bring about change designed to channel and coordinate community, regional, and state resources for P20 students, teachers, and industry professionals. Our STEM hub uses a collective impact model which engages over 30 partners from K-12 schools, higher education, business, and out-of-school STEM providers. Our partners have agreed to 5 founding principles. We have a common mission, we have aligned efforts, a common system to measure success, open communication, and a backbone organization. Our backbone organization is the Intel Center for College and Career Readiness. Our partners include 3 of the 5 largest school districts in Oregon, Oregon's largest private employer, the largest university system, and the largest university in the Oregon University System, and our state's only comprehensive healthcare university. Our goal is to measurably increase college and career readiness of K-12 students by engaging them and their teachers in whole school partnerships that transform teaching and learning of science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Our partnership strategy is to align assets by forming networked improvement communities that operate through district-wide initiatives as well as whole school investment plans. In summary, Oregon's STEM education system has not demonstrated the ability to self-correct and a timeline that meets the STEM workforce demands. I believe our state needs to be proactive and take bold steps to transform STEM teaching and learning system. We also need to build and bring to scale infrastructure that will mobilize, align, and sustain community members as they empower teachers to transform education in our schools. I ask that you consider this work to be among your highest priority issues in this legislative session.
Thank you very much, Dr. Becker. Lita.
Okay, great. Good morning, Chair Dembrough, Vice Chair Harker, Vice Chair Huffman. I'm Lita Colligan. I'm Associate Vice President for Strategic Partnerships at Oregon Tech, also known as Oregon Institute of Technology, Oregon's public polytechnic STEM university. I'm also one of the conveners of the South Metro Salem STEM Partnership, modeled after the distinguished work of my colleague here from PSU. I'm here to thank you, most of all, for putting a focus on STEM education. It's really, really important, as you've been hearing this morning, and for inviting me to make a few comments about House Bill 2636. As a university administrator and facilitator of a STEM partnership, and someone who's committed her career to workforce development and applied education, I'm convinced that hands-on experiential learning is what ignites the passion of all learners and is what leads to higher achievement in school and to selection of STEM careers by students. House Bill 2636 has the potential to ignite the passion of students throughout Oregon. As the partnership person at Oregon Tech, I cannot speak for all the colleges and universities in Oregon, but I am aware that both of my colleagues here and all of the campuses in the system are working feverishly to build the bridges and the transitions for students so we can shift from remediation to student-driven motivation and excitement and college and career readiness. Students today, like Savannah, who you're going to hear from, want to solve the world's great challenges. And we can help them do so by giving them both academic and experiential knowledge and skills in STEM. This bill could provide that essential leadership through the council and the essential resources through the investment fund to make that happen. As many of you are aware, Deb Mumhill from FIRST Robotics and I have facilitated the formation of the South Metro Salem STEM Partnership, modeled after Dr. Becker's work, which is a coalition of 13 school districts from Westland Wilsonville to Woodburn to Salem Kaiser to McMinnville, 3 community colleges, Chemeketa, Clackamas, and PCC Newburgh, 3 universities, including Western and Pacific, and 6 community-based organizations, including FIRST Robotics and Evergreen, and last week, NASA's Oregon Space Grant Consortium, and over 15 business partners, including Intel, Mentor Graphics, Legacy, and Garmin. Modeled after the work, again, of Bill Becker, our goal is to catalyze Oregon students to achieve degrees and certificates in STEM. What's important here is that we're working together. Together, we're focused on doubling the number of college graduates that matriculate from partner schools and increasing the participation of underrepresented students in STEM. So on behalf of Oregon Tech and also the South Metro STEM Partnership, I ask the committee to consider 3 issues in your deliberations, which I think are really, really important. First, leverage. It's been mentioned before. I'd like to mention it again. Collaboration and leverage are really essential. The STEM partnerships or hubs are all about that. And Oregon will get more for its money if the grants awarded from the STEM investment account are connected to a regional strategy or a hub of some kind. We'll be able to reach more students and teachers, and we'll be bringing in the resources, the rich resources in our communities. Right now, there are STEM partnerships, as we've mentioned, in the metro area, in the South Metro area, on the coast with Oregon State, in the Gorge with the Gorge Technology Alliance, with Eastern and the Eastern Promise, and many other places. So this isn't just a metro area initiative. If the grants are connected to a collective vision, as we've described, if they're connected to something bigger, then we'll have more people pulling in a common direction, and we'll get way more leverage for our dollars. The second issue is it matters where the money comes from, and that some questions were asked earlier of the committee. When Deb and I brought House Bill 2636 to our STEM partnership meeting, there was quite a bit of concern from people about it not subtracting from other good programs and services, and that we end up with a net gain as a result of this bill rather than a subtraction. So that's important. And then finally,
if you could wrap up.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, we're running.
Finally, we don't need to reinvent the wheel. Oregon will achieve a more immediate and lasting impact if we invest in evidence-based effective practices. First has been mentioned here before. Project Lead the Way is another. We have lots and lots of really good nationally recognized programs as well as very good proven practices locally. For example, there were 15 first robotics teams in Oregon 6 years ago. There's now over 130. And those students move up into our Oregon University system. So I guess I'd like to just ensure that the STEM grants proliferate proven practices and that we don't start from scratch with a lot of pilot programs. I hope that the STEM Council and the investment account described in the bill have a huge impact on student achievement, but I also think a bigger game changer might be when the achievement compacts for every school, college, and university include not just the number of degrees, but the number of degrees in STEM and high-demand fields. I urge you to support House Bill 2636 so we can close the skill gap we've been talking about between high-skilled jobs and the skills of Oregonians. And I thank you and urge you to or ask you to consider my suggestions in your final version of the bill.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much, panel. I know we'd all like to dialogue with you a little more, but we're going to have to move on. Thank you very much for coming. And, you know, let me say to the audience, we have two more panels we have to get through very quickly. And if anyone has come here in the hopes of who's signed up to speak to this bill, we're not going to have time to get to that today. But I will say that we will have at least one further public hearing on this bill. So, you'll have plenty of opportunity to weigh in on this issue. So I'd like to call up Savannah Loberger, Bryn Livesey, and Terrell Smith.
Thank you, Chair Denver, for having us here today, and committee as well. My name is Bryn Livesey, and I'm a senior majoring in chemical engineering at Oregon State University. I've been an Oregonian my entire life. I've been in the Oregon public education system since I was five, started full-day kindergarten at Wilsonville Primary School. But I really wanted to provide for you guys today the student perspective. So I've been involved in STEM education both on the receiving and delivering end. I obviously went through public school here in Oregon and kind of ended up in the STEM field on accident. I didn't have a lot of the support through school of role models or coaches to help me get there. It was kind of, my mom was like, hey, you should go into engineering. I was like, okay. But what I think is really important for the committee to see is that engineering and science really make an impact on Oregonians and really make an impact on our communities, and they're really the professionals that are going to help us improve healthcare, alternative energies, and really make our state awesome. And students want to be a part of things that are awesome, but they need to know that they're out there. I've visited dozens of Oregon high schools, and the first question when I walk into classrooms is, what is an engineer, what is engineering. And you would be surprised by how many students don't even know what engineering is. And I think that that's one of the issues we really need to resolve, is really making sure that students have those role models in engineering and science, and know that it's a cool thing to go into. And that's really what's going to boost the number of engineers and scientists our state's able to produce, is that awareness and that understanding that this is a really great field to go into. And we have a lot of companies that are really excited about hiring our students. So I've been at Oregon State, and I've seen that we do have a lot of students who are really excited about going in to these fields, and I just really encourage you to continuing our financial support of these programs, because it's really, really important. So I'm going to pass the ball over to Savannah, and she's going to talk a little bit about some of her experiences.
Thank you, Brody.
All right, Chair Dembro and the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. My name is Savannah Loberger. I am a senior at Hillsborough High School, and I was the only high school student on the STEM task force. This House Bill 2636 is tremendously important for Oregon and our students. Offering a grant process is a great idea and follows the CTE revitalization model from the previous session. The goal of doubling the number of STEM post-secondary graduates is admirable. To do this, we need to increase the number of students choosing post-secondary STEM 4 to 6-fold. Now, how do kids choose their degree? How did I choose biomedical engineering and computer science? Because of coaches, mentors, and after-school time, where I've worked with professionals in industry while solving problems, I've gained the ability to speak with adults and the confidence to speak with you today. I have experiences building and creating new robots that actually work. Because of coaching, I have confidence in myself to become an engineer. At my high school, just in FTC Robotics, each team member has put in over 200 hours of hands-on experiences after school. Now, unfortunately, not everyone has that chance. A semester course is 72 hours, and in a crowded classroom, there is no time and no opportunity for 45 kids to get their hands on a robot. And so many schools have no after-school program. United States high schools create the best quarterbacks and the best linemen. We have world superiority in this area of working with students. Now, what is the secret to such phenomenal success with kids? While STEM in the U.S. is behind so many other countries, sports have survived decades and numerous budget cuts. Now, ask yourself, why are sports so successful with kids? Coaching and individual attention. What would our sports program look like if there are no paid coaches, no paid officials for the games, no paid athletic directors at the high schools? Would we have the extensive network of sports facilities that every community needs and brags about? Students and parents see where they get coaching and individual attention. Students can easily find coaches that will help them in sports, drama, band, cheerleading. Schools pay coaches in those positions. STEM fields and companies are competing for the best kids from a system that does not honor kids in STEM with coaching. The current lack of paid STEM coaches has sent a very clear message to all of us that STEM is not as important as other opportunities for students. Now, Einstein said you cannot solve a problem with the same thinking that got you into the problem. It is past time to level the playing field. Now is the time to offer STEM students coaching, just like all the other opportunities students have to excel, to show their parents, teachers, and other students what they can do. At least 10% or 10 to 20% of the money in this bill needs to go to providing STEM coaching directly to students in things like FIRST Robotics, Science Fair, and computer science related activities. These programs facilitate problem solving and real world thinking and experiences that cannot be without adult guidance and cannot be learned from a textbook. Students involved in science, technology, engineering, and math need coaching and mentoring just as much as athletes, musicians, and thespians. A combination of in-class and out-of-school experiences creates success. You need us kids to be engaged, and that is through projects, and that is through coaching. Our success comes when there is a long-term investment put into STEM from kids themselves. We succeed when adults mentor us, when adults coach us, when adults invest in us. Then, more of us will choose STEM degrees. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Savannah. You grow more articulate with every testimony. Thank you. Mr. Smith.
Representative Dembro and committee, my name is Terrell Smith. I teach computer science in a CTE program at Sherwood High School. And I think I'm done here. What you just heard is the voice that we need to hear and the compelling reasons why this bill is on the table and why it should be passed. A couple things I will say, however, is that my friend Kevin Costner in Field of Dreams said, if we build it, they will come. I'm not sure that works here because we do have a pipeline and we do have a capacity at the higher ed system, but we're not filling it. Maybe if we re-engineer the comment and say, if they come, we will build it. So that's what the bill is, and that's what I can offer as a teacher in the K-12 system is some successes, and they're in the report. We don't need to go into them today. You've just heard about a couple of them. These girls and women that are moving into our system, they are in the pipeline, and they got there, maybe in Bryn's case, by happenstance, but Savannah by design. And if we were to scale that design where a Hillsborough community and Hillsborough School District and Sherwood and some of the model school districts in the state, we scale that through the up to the provide those opportunities for all communities in the state through this bill, then we will fill that pipeline. They will come, and then we'll have to build it. And our industry will, and our community, and our economic state of our economic in Oregon will benefit. So I've taught science and technology in Sherwood School District for 34 years. I have seen the good. I've seen the rough spots. I've seen where we can improve and what we should do for our students and for our young citizens. I think we really do need to honor our young citizens by fully funding education to allow these programs to be established and reestablished in many cases. Through defunding of education, I have seen my peers that have lost their programs, and now we have a compelling reason to put them back in, and this bill would be a great way to start that action, and we three fully support whatever you can do to move this bill forward.
Thank you, Mrs. Smith. Thank you, all three of you, for being here today. I want to call up the final panel, which will have to be brief, I'm afraid, and that's Thompson Morrison and Eric Mislow. Mr. Morrison, if you could identify yourself for the record.
Absolutely. Thank you, Chair Dembrow and committee. I am Thompson Morrison. I am the CEO of a software company called Fuse Insight. I am also the board member of the TAO, the Technology Association of Oregon. I also am the president of TAO's technology education foundation called TechStart. But of all those hats, the most important hat that I wear is as a parent. And a parent with children in the high schools here in Oregon. So last October, I was asked to come in front of the high school that where my daughter is at, Franklin High School, and to present to the seniors in the career day. And at that career day, I was preceded by someone from the department talking about workforce and talking about where the jobs were. And they were talking about how the jobs in our economy itself is being driven by two important clusters, advanced manufacturing and software. She then asked these seniors how many of them were interested in going into computer science. Out of these 375 students at Franklin High School in Portland, Oregon, three students raised their hands. I'm standing there, And I know, as the board member of the TAO, that our most pressing problem in our industry is talent. It's a desperate situation. It is at a point of a crisis. We have had to institute ways to find new mechanisms to bring talent to our industry because we do not have enough people here. We have open recs by the hundreds. And so I'm sitting there looking at these kids and thinking, we have a problem. So as I stand before them, I began to ask them. I said, who has a smartphone? Who surfs the web? Who has ever played a video game? And they're all nodding their heads. I'm saying, yes, of course. This is really interesting stuff. This is cool. And in fact, the digital technologies is transforming every single industry, from farming, food processing, to medicine, to manufacturing. And that if you are not digitally literate in tomorrow's economy, and in fact today's economy, you are going to fall behind, desperately behind. Digital literacy is essential in any career you go into. And at the end of that, a senior raised his hand. And he said, Mr. Morrison, we understand that. We really do. We're graduating in 6 months. What have you done to prepare us for that new world? And these are kids I've known since they were in diapers. And I said, you know, you're right. We have failed. So I began throwing out an idea to them. What would happen if we took all the resources of the Technology Association, our 300-plus companies, out of that, pulled mentors, began to create those after-school programs where you could actually work on projects that were fun, interesting, and you could see the people who are doing this amazing work? How many of you guys would be interested in doing that? 60 or 70 of those kids raised their hands. And I said, yeah. Okay. We commit to you that by the beginning of the spring term, we will have that in place for you. So you have at least one term of exposure, of practice, of coaching for my industry before we send you off. And then we will put that in place for the rest of the students. And then I asked the students, what do we call this thing? And a girl raised her hand and said, we're going to call it Tech for Tomorrow. So I began floating that idea around with my colleagues. I said, hey, the students want to do this. What do you think? And they said, yeah, what a great idea. So in the first week of January, we pulled together an amazing group of people around the industry. We had educators, we had legislators, we had people from the industry, we had software developers, and say, we have 6 weeks before the beginning of the term. We've committed to them to launch this. And we've committed not only to launch this at Franklin, but to create a model that we can scale to every high school in the state. Can we do that? Because in our world, we work fast. Can we do that? And they said, yes, we can do that. And we've done it. In 6 weeks, with hundreds of conversations, virtual conversations, we've actually launched a program at Franklin High School that is to be designed as a model for our state. Bringing together the expertise of Hillsborough High with Don Domes, bringing together expertise from the legislative board with Representative Parker, pulling together expertise from the industry, saying, we can do this. We can do this in partnership with our government, in partnership as a public-private, because we need to do this together. And so I come here today to demonstrate that this, we're not asking you guys, our legislative bodies, our representatives, to solve our problems. We're asking for a partnership. And a partnership that allows us to release this incredible talent that we have of our industry and our kids to allow us to be able to quickly form new strategies, to invest strategically in those that we can scale. Because this is our Sputnik moment. This really is. I spent 12 years living in China. I have seen that economy be transformed. There are twice as many smartphones being sold this year in China as in the United States. That means a quarter of a billion smartphones in China. This is a very technologically savvy culture. And the whole region is. And the whole country is. We don't have time to sit back. This is our time to act. This is a small first step. It's an important strategic first step. But it is an essential first step with this bill. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Morrison.
Nicely done.
Eric, if you could be brief.
I will try.
And of course, you'll be coming back. And let me just say, first of all, thank you always, Eric, for, you know, the volunteer thank work you. That you do on this issue.
Well, I appreciate the compliment. Thank you very much, Chair. Chair Dembrough, Vice Chair Harker, Vice Chair Huffman, members of the committee. My name is Eric Meslow. I have a series of titles here that I actually have to write down occasionally to remember them all. I'm the current chair of the Engineering Technology Industry Council, ETIC. I'm the co-chair with Jill with the STEM Employees Coalition. I was also a member of the task force. I also sit on TAO's board as well, and somewhere in there, I'm the president of Timmercon, a high-tech company in Portland, Oregon. I have found myself in this position many times where, at the end of testimony, I really just need to shut up. Everybody in front of me basically said what I would say at this point. The passion that I think you've heard from industry about the need, the educators about the innovation and the programs and the intriguing ways they believe they can solve this problem. Frankly, the thing that I enjoy the most is listening to the students and the absolute outpouring of lust for the topic and the passion for their futures is very inspiring to me and is what makes me spend so much of my free time advocating on their behalf. I do urge the passing of House Bill 2636. I know it's a difficult session. It's going to be a tough pull, but I would like to say that everybody involved today is here to answer your questions and try to make the best case forward for the state's economy and the kids of this great community. At this point, if you do have any quick questions, I certainly would be more than happy to answer them.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Eric. And I don't think we do have time for questions, but let me say that as this bill develops, we're going to, you know, Rep. Harker is going to be leading the effort to get this bill in a form where it's going to have the greatest chance of success as we send it down to Ways and Means. You know, I think that, I don't know about my colleagues, but I've been very inspired by what I've heard today. And, you know, the charge that you've given us of taking this and moving it forward, I'm personally committed to, and I think we probably all are. Yes, Rep. Greenlick.
Yeah, I do want to point out that there are things going on, and I was intrigued at Franklin. My son-in-law is a teacher teaching a class that leads to health occupations, a class in medical technology, and I think we want to not underestimate where there are things going on to help encourage them, because I think there are folks out in the field. They feel kind of lonesome sometimes out there, I think.
If I could make one quick comment, Representative Greenlick. Yes, there are hundreds of programs across the state that are doing fantastic work around this area, from K-12, community college, and at the university level, and they're reaching thousands of kids, but they're leaving out tens of thousands of kids
absolutely.
At this time.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
As they go away, could I say one?
Sure.
Okay. First off, very inspiring, and secondly, also from the high school and the college students, impressive, very impressive. It looks to me like we're doing some decent and correct things in education because they're fine representatives of that. And finally, it's really nice to see my old alma mater, Franklin High School, fighting Quakers. Doing something that, you know, is in the forefront.
Yes. That's why it was with trepidation that I recognized you.
Oh, that hurts.
I knew that was coming.
You knew. Okay. Yeah, I couldn't not say
so. So with that, I'm going to close this public hearing on House Bill 2636, and I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2838. Thank you for your patience, those of you who've come for that bill. Victoria, would you please tell us what this is?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2838 directs Oregon Education Investment Board, Oregon University System, and Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development to pay forward payback pilot program to replace current system of tuition and fees required to attend institutions of higher education and establishes criteria for the program. Requires submission of proposal to 78th Legislative Assembly for approval. Declares emergency effective on passage.
Okay. Thank you very much, Victoria. And now to tell us about this concept and to lay the background for it, we have our first panel, Tracy Gibbs, Jason Jimkarinen, and Tiffany Dollar.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Danborough and members of the committee, for this opportunity to testify for support of House Bill 2838. And for the record, my name is Tracy Gibbs, and I am here from Portland State University.
Yes, go ahead. Just some noise control here. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
As a current Portland State student, I wanted to lend my support for this innovative bill, House Bill 2838, otherwise known as Pay Forward Payback Proposal. I appreciate the legislature's openness to listen to proposals that can make college affordable for Oregon students, as well as the openness to listen to proposals like the previous bill for STEM programs. The student debt crisis is a crisis that's taking its toll on an already weak economy. There's no doubt that the student loan debt looms as a major long-term problem facing the state's population of college graduates and beyond. The economy might be seeking a modest recovery of late, but there is no doubt that there isn't any relief coming soon for this pocket of borrowers. Higher education is an integral part of the American dream, but today more and more young people and their families have increasingly had to finance their education or their child's education through student loans. And behind these stark realities is the impact that these trends are having on Oregon students. In fact, the impact extends beyond students, burdening their immediate families for decades. This threatens the ability for current and future generations to build successful careers, contribute to the economy, and it affects the ability for previous generations to save for their own future. The overwhelming debt many students face leave them unable to wait for higher paying jobs and forces them to take lower paying jobs in order to stop payments and interest from ballooning. This results in fewer graduates starting their own businesses and negatively affects the economy as a whole. Additionally, this is not even... Sorry. I'm a little nervous. The escalation of college costs at Oregon colleges and universities has resulted in many students and families barely scraping by and having to turn down admissions to their top choice schools they couldn't afford or delaying college altogether, where some students leave school with debt and no degree. From managing soaring tuition costs to streamlining financial aid, the post-secondary education system in Oregon needs reform. The current student system does not work for many Oregonians looking for access to and success in higher education. I believe that college cultivates intellectual traits and has inherent value. Academics are not just exploring subject areas. It also educates students socially. The education that arises out of experience is the best of its kind. The real value of higher education is self-realization, and unfortunately for many Oregonians, opportunities for a lightning education like mine are being closed. Their self-realization is that they won't be able to afford to go to college. My fear is that if we as a state do not respond to the student debt crisis, we will be influencing the direction of the escalating cost of college to continue. I support the House Bill 2838 because it's a dramatically different approach, one that demonstrates shared responsibility and commitment for future generations and a seriousness about the value of higher education. Pay It Forward represents a social commitment and not a debt. The state will maintain at least current level of funding for higher education for this bill. We have the opportunity to make a dramatic impact on Oregon's most pressing and societal problems and to fulfill a promise to those students who do work hard, graduate from high school, and look to our public colleges and universities as a pathway to the better future. We owe them nothing less. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today, and if you have any more questions about my written testimony, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you. Jason.
All right, good morning, Chairman Dembro. Ma'am, gentlemen, thank you for hearing us today. My name is Jason Yunkarinen. I'm a senior at Portland State University studying economics. I'm also a student in the Russian flagship program there. I'm going to graduate with my degree in economics at the end of this term, actually. I've got like 3 weeks left. Thank you. I'm going to be sticking around at Portland State for another year and a half to finish the domestic requirements of the flagship program, after which I'm going to apply for a full year of language study abroad at St. Petersburg State University. Got my fingers crossed for the Bourne Scholarship, but all said and done, after about 7 years of higher education, I'm going to have a bachelor's degree in economics, a certificate of advanced proficiency in Russian through the National Language Flagship, and just shy of $100,000 in student debt. And I can look forward to paying that off at about the middle of the GS-6 scale, because I plan to go into government work when I finally get out of school. And under current repayment options, that's not going to go very well. I can tell you, I mean, there are programs in existence to make things easier, but the way the system is right now, it flatly doesn't work. I was a student in the fall 2012 capstone class, student debt, economics, policy, and advocacy, along with Tracy over here. And in our final presentation, we laid out the problems with the current system, which there are many. We've been talking about that for a while. We also laid the groundwork for the bill that we're discussing today. As a current student in the Oregon University system, a founding member of the Students for Educational Debt Reform, and a soon-to-be economist, I wholeheartedly endorse and support the Pay It Forward program for the state of Oregon. It really is a step forward. I'd like to discuss quickly some differences between the Pay It Forward program and the current system that we're working with right now. On the surface, there seem to be a lot of similarities between income-based repayment of loans and the Pay It Forward program, but to put it simply, I mean, they are completely different. The Pay It Forward program is not a loan system. Under income-based repayment, student repays loans based on 10% of their adjusted gross income until their debt is paid off or a sufficiently large time goes by. Under the Pay It Forward system, student pays 3% of their adjusted gross income for a fixed length of time, not for a fixed amount of money. And that money doesn't go to the bank or the entity that holds the loan in income-based repayment. It goes straight into the fund that runs the higher education system in the state of Oregon. As a current student, you know, the difference between the two programs is honestly startling. Assuming I'm sitting around GS-6 Step 3 for the Portland area, it's a salary of roughly $37,000 a year. Between the 3% payment into the Pay It Forward program and the 10% payment for a loan, that's an extra $2,500 a year that I am not paying to loans and interest, and that I am paying into the state of Oregon. Just as a student, that's $2,500 that I will never have to put on a credit card in case something bad happens, because that's one of the other things we discussed was credit card debt among recent graduates and young people. And there's been a lot of talk about, you know, like, yeah, we want the big TV, we want to drive fast cars. Well, honestly, the research shows that the source of most of that debt is survival spending. Something goes wrong, you need to fix the car. Bad things happen. And under the Pay It Forward program, that extra money is going to be there. From my perspective as an economist, that's an extra $2,500 that's going back into the economy and supporting growth. Whether the money is spent on consumption or saved in the bank, that's instantaneous growth to the economy of Oregon right there. In conclusion, I wholly support the Pay It Forward program, and I hope that we can move forward on this. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to take them right now. Thank you.
Thank you, Jason. And Tiffany, welcome back.
Good morning, Chair Dembro, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tiffany Dollar, and I'm here speaking on behalf of the Oregon Student Association regarding House Bill 2838, Pay It Forward. Before I dive into my testimony, which is actually pretty brief, I wanted to acknowledge the work of the Capstone and also the fact that this is a really interesting proposal, and I think that the idea of this bill being a task force bill says that there's still a lot of conversations to be had about the nitty-gritty, so I'll be a little less technical in my testimony. And also just wanted to bring it back to, I do agree with a lot of Tracy's comments about the individual growth that can happen when somebody pursues a post-secondary education degree, but also acknowledge that higher education is really a public good and serves to reinvigorate the economy of the entire state, and just to bring it back to that, because I think those are some important themes and points that we talk about when we talk about higher education. I have the honor of serving as the student body president at Portland State, which, as you've already heard, is Oregon's largest university, and I also sit on the OSA Board of Directors. The OSA is comprised of elected student leadership from public colleges around the state and represents over 100,000 students. Our mission is to increase affordability and access to public post-secondary education, and that's why we're really excited to talk about exploring this type of proposal today. I'm going to talk a little bit about my personal educational experience and why I think it's important that we explore this proposal. I attended more than 13 different schools in my K through 12 career before graduating from David Douglas High School in Portland, Oregon. This included four different schools in Oregon and Washington in just the third grade, which we all know is a really important time for students. And I didn't start fifth grade until March of that academic year. So needless to go further into that, definitely faced some barriers in my education, really unstable childhood that made it hard for me to see long-term where my place was in higher ed. I'm a non-traditional first-generation transfer student with an Associate of Arts Oregon transfer degree. I paid for the first year at PCC out of pocket while working full-time in healthcare because I wasn't able to receive financial aid. My parents weren't filing their taxes, and I was still too young to file independently, although I had taken some time off before going back to school. After a year of that, I was able to appeal that process and file independently and get financial aid. I did get both grants and loans and continued to work not full-time but part-time to help supplement my income when I was in community college. And now I'm nearing the end of my senior year at Portland State, and I'll be graduating with more than $30,000 in student loan debt, not nearly as much, but still, that number, it really stands out because it's not a unique number. The Oregonian reported late last year that Portland State's class of 2010 borrowed more than any other OUS institution at an average of $26,200 per student. And those are people at the high end with hundreds of thousands of dollars of debt and people at the low end with no debt. So I'm not that much more than average. I've heard in this very committee how the funding ratio has flipped in the last decade, shifting the burden of operating our colleges onto the backs of students who are now paying, on average, two-thirds of the operating costs of our institutions and the state the remainder. During our tuition conversations on my campus, PSU's Vice President of Finance and Administration informed students that these numbers are even more extreme at PSU, where students pay more than 80%
of the total costs of operating our campus right now. It's no wonder that student loan debt has outpaced credit card debt and amounts to more than $1 trillion nationally. We need to reinvest in post-secondary education, and this proposal provides us an opportunity to start that conversation. Estimates show that under this model, 3% of an individual's income for 24 years would cover 4 years of tuition and fees and pay an additional $7,400 into the fund that was mentioned earlier. While California, Washington, Vermont, and Pennsylvania are all talking about pay it forward, Oregon is leading the conversation. Oregon is known for its pioneering spirit, so let's pave the way to an end to student loan debt. Please support the Pay It Forward Task Force. Thank you for your time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, panel, for setting this up for us. Are there any quick questions? The next panel will go into some more of the details, I think, of the plan itself. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tiffany, I wondered if the students had talked about, in terms of eligibility for this, if certain degrees would be eligible for it, i.e. because they'd be more valuable to our economy and other degrees wouldn't be eligible for it. Have we had that conversation at all?
I'm going to defer this question to folks who worked on the capstone because I wasn't a developer of this proposal, but thank you for the question.
I'll answer the question, Representative Johnson and members of the committee. It is open for all majors. We haven't classified or quantified by major as far as the proposal goes. We're opening it up for everybody. We are open for, you know, some insight as far as how long the program's going to be, and it's going to be a part of your adjusted gross income. The further panel will go into more details about it, but for right now, it's open for all majors.
Follow up?
Yes, follow up.
Tiffany, you mentioned that this would impact affordability. I can see that from the standpoint of maybe the pocketbook of the students, but in terms of trying to hold down cost drivers within the system, I have a hard time seeing how it's going to put any additional pressure on the system to keep the cost of tuition low if there's another way to make that more affordable. It kind of impedes or takes away the impetus on the part of the consumers to hold that cost down if it's somehow spread over a much longer period of time. So could you just talk about that a bit?
Sure. Thank you, Representative Dembro and Representative Johnson, for having us up here again, and thanks for the question. I think that the goal is to start a conversation about those cost drivers, and I think it's really important that you brought it up. We know that a big part of that is what increases the cost of tuition right now for us is the changing ratios that I kind of mentioned before. And I think that in the long term, we should be having conversations about reinvestment. And if that means creating a fund that's based over the long term, where students pay for the cost of their attendance plus going and benefiting some future attendance, that is a good place to start the conversation. But I definitely think that it's only a start, and those are conversations that we'd be happy to continue to have.
Yes, thank you, Tiffany. We did hear last week or the week before from Jay Kenton that in fact, the costs per student have not risen in this state once you factor out inflation over the last 20 years. So, you know, again, the challenge is not so much the rising costs, in my opinion, so much as just how do we pay for this and how do we keep the burden from being shifted onto the backs of students. So, yes, Rep. Raymond.
A quick question. What happens if you decide to go for a master's degree and then a PhD? Does that go into 6% and then 9% of your income?
Yes.
Hi, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Greenlick, thank you for the question. The way we discussed it in the capstone class was that it was going to be essentially 1/4 of 3% of your adjusted gross income for every year that you attend school. So for students who take a few extra years, whether to complete two bachelor's degrees or continue through graduate school, it would increase appropriately based on the number of years of attendance.
So it might turn into 12 quarters of 3% if you were there 12 years or something like that. I mean, this isn't
going for a PhD.
It's only for the undergraduate degree, or is it intended to be for advanced degrees as well? And if so, does it, if I get 8 years or something, do I pay 6% of my income?
Mm-hmm. So the specific numbers need to be figured out. The idea is that it would be equivalent for every year. That being said, people with advanced degrees tend to have a higher income, and the university fund would be able to recover the costs faster at a lower percentage. So that needs to be determined through further research, but
a lot more research.
Okay, great. Rep. Huffman, then we'll have to move on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thoughts about how and who would administer the program? And part of the reason for this question, other than it's a common sense question, is the other day I asked a panel about the Oregon Opportunity Grant and following the money and who has actually received Opportunity Grant money and a degree, and nobody could answer that question. I would hope that there would be a solid plan in place that would address this better than what we're currently doing with an existing program. Was that part of, was it discussed, Tracy?
Yeah, that was Chair Dembro, members of the committee, and Representative Huffman. It was discussed. You're going to be hearing more in detail from the second panel from this, but there have been some ideas flowing around as far as with Pay It Forward having the IRS do it as far as funding for it, as well as through the Oregon Opportunity Grant. Again, that would be the job of the interim task force to answer those questions, but those are a few of the ideas. So
thank you.
All right, thank you very much, panel. And as you leave and as the next panel comes up, I just want to say again how much I admire the work of the Capstone Group. You know, this is what, you know, higher education should be all about, students who are bringing their learning together to make change in our world. So thank you very much. And with that, I call up John Burbank, Jason Gettle, and Mary King, please. And again, if you all could be brief, please. If you have prepared remarks, please submit them, and if you could summarize them, that would be great.
Mr. Chair, are we getting 10 copies of the testimony? Or has that been, I think the administrator said all the testimony will be. Thank you.
Okay, who's starting?
John is.
John.
Just a minute while we get this ready to roll here. Thank you, Chair Devereaux and members of the committee. My name is John Burbank. I'm the Executive Director of the Economic Opportunity Institute in Seattle. We are a think tank for the middle class. We focus on issues of economic security and educational opportunity for middle class and low-income families. So higher education has become a very important issue for us. And I wanted to mention, coming from Seattle, first of all, we also have a Franklin High School, and we have the Fighting Quakers in Seattle.
More than I thought.
And as you know, we drink a lot of espresso, so it was a relief for me to find the Governor's Cup right next down the street, and also to put all my quarters into the parking meter. So,
thanks for helping, Eric. No sales tax, though.
No sales tax. Yes. Let me actually address some questions that came up immediately at the beginning from Representative Huffman about how you implement this and track graduates. And I think that especially for us in the state of Washington, where we don't have an income tax, we have to have a relationship with the IRS. And in fact, all states that participate in this will have to have a relationship with the IRS, because you need to be able to follow graduates as they cross state borders and cross national borders. And we have begun discussions with Deputy Secretary of the Treasury, Mark Every, who's very interested in this proposal and is very interested in helping to work out the kinks and make this a real feasible option. So let me, I put together a brief PowerPoint, so let me start to go through this. That's the wrong thing. So how does it work? So we replace tuition with postgraduate contributions into a state trust fund. It funds future students from this trust fund, and future students will also participate in Pay It Forward. It's a pragmatic business model for funding higher education. It actually has its genesis through an economist named Milton Friedman, who was trying to figure out how you monetize the human capital that a person can gain through higher education. It ensures accessibility and affordability. We were here at the STEM conversation a little bit earlier, and one of the biggest barriers for STEM and for all higher education is frankly just the financial and the psychological barriers of getting into higher education through tuition. And it pretty much demolishes those barriers. It's not intended, and I think this is really important, it's not intended to replace public state contributions to higher education. I think you know this, and my colleague's going to talk about this more, so I'm just going to skip over this, but that's increases in tuition and fees between 2005, 2006 and the present time. That's in current dollars. If it's in constant dollars, it's about 29%. This is something that's happening all across the country. In our state, University of Washington, tuition has gone up over 600% between 1981 and now in constant dollars. So here's how it works. You go to college without upfront cost. You contribute a fixed percent of income for a predetermined number of years to a higher education trust fund after graduation, and this fund enables access for the next generational cohort of students. And notice that I don't put any numbers down here because these are all sort of actuarial calculations that we have roughly developed, but they're not certain yet. In our state, we're looking at, for example, 4% or 1% per year for public four-year higher education and 0.75% for public community college education per year. And then you can slice and dice this. So, for example, none of us really know the future of higher education in terms of online learning and MOOCs and things like that. But we do know that the public institutions are the gateway for the vast majority of students. So we need to figure out how we can open up that door rather than close it. So we abolish and replace tuition. It's free and open access to all qualified tuition students. It increases career choice at college and after graduation, and it zeroes out student debt. The contributions are proportional to income. They're based on market income. So it's a rough estimate, as I said before, of human capital development gained through higher education. You'll notice that STEM programs actually require a greater investment of public resources than, say, an English literature degree. And most likely the STEM graduates will have a higher income than an English literature graduate like my daughter. As a result, you want to actually include the whole pool of higher education and building our collective intelligence and wisdom. So this is how it works. If Haley's a high school senior, she goes to a four-year college, she'll pay 4%. If she makes $30,000, she's going to pay $100 a month. If she makes $60,000, she'll pay twice as much. And these figures in this bar chart is based upon Census Bureau figures of the income of graduates 5, 10, 15, 20, 25 years after graduation. So these are not made-up numbers. If she goes to a community college, she'll pay 1.5% of adjusted gross income for 25 years. So again, if she makes $30,000, she'll be paying about $37.25 a month, which is a lot less than at least than my cell phone bill. So we can do this through several ways. Statewide implementation, you can see this is not the Oregon State Capitol, but the Washington State Capitol. We can do transition to pay it forward in all colleges and all universities. That would cost about $600 million in year one, about $1.4 billion in year four. Then it goes down after that as graduates pay in to pay it forward. Year 25, you have net revenue, and after that, you have net revenue growing over time. You can do it with pilot programs, and this is something that is that we're exploring here. And I wanted to mention also that we, in the state of Washington, we're working with the House Higher Education Committee as well, and developing a budget proviso so that we will be funding the state actuary and the state student achievement council and a couple of universities to actually explore and develop implementation. So much like the bill that you're considering, it's just a budget proviso. You can do a pilot program with a smaller university or community college. We have, in our state, 32,000 students who had been eligible for the state need grant. These are very low-income students, but who did not receive this grant. So if we could figure out an independent funding source for those students and have them put onto a pay-it-forward model, then that would create an expanding funding pool. It could be for STEM majors, something that was brought up earlier. It could be for medical professions, and let me talk a little bit about this. We've done a model where, and this is important for Oregon Health Science University, is that, you know, in the state of Washington, medical school tuition is $56,000 a year. So you get medical students coming out as doctors, and they're carrying along a debt of $300,000. It's one of the drivers for doctors going into specialties instead of into primary care. It's one of the drivers for medical inflation. If you were to end that practice and say, okay, we're going to put you on a pay-it-forward system, you will go to medical school for free, essentially, and you will pay 5% of your income for 25 years after medical school. That would completely finance the system. So we can do something like that, and you can do it for the whole array from certified medical assistants to RNs to LPNs to PAs to MDs. There's also a model that we're developing now for parental participation, so we could pre-fund pay it forward, such that as a family, you could decide, okay, we're going to put 4% of our income into pay it forward for 5 years before our child goes to school, and then the child is responsible for 20 years after graduation. So these pay it forward contributions can be split up between the family and the graduate. Just to give you a sense of how this would work, so Oregon State University tuition is about $8,091 a year, correct? It's more or less like that, right? So if we were to fund 1,000 people, 1,000 students on this, and put them all on Pay It Forward, then their participation in Pay It Forward would create, as you can see, by year 30, instead of $8 million, you get up to $33.5 million. That would allow the number of students on OSU Promise 1,000 to grow.
Could you go back to that slide? Explain that. I didn't understand your last slide.
Please. Ah, okay. Now I have to.
I apologize.
No, let's go back. That doesn't work. So, okay. So how this works is that you put each of these students on Pay It Forward. When they graduate, then assuming that the state maintains its constant investment of $8,091,000, then the contributions of the Pay It Forward graduates add to that over time. They allow the accretion of more and more students over time who are also in Pay It Forward, and so their contributions over time further add to the pool. So that's how you have this increasing amount of money over time. And that results in the ability to accrete more and more students into Pay It Forward over time as well, with this, with the constant investment of $8 million by the state.
Mm-hmm. But if I could jump in there, I mean, the costs of education will continue to rise. So how do you hold that contribution constant?
The total cost of education in our state, and I think in Oregon State as well, have been pretty flat over time. So for the past 20 years, if you add in the state cost and the tuition cost, it's been actually the cost of the University of Washington has actually gone down. So what's been driving the tuition cost is not the increased cost in higher education, but rather the diminution of state funding for higher education.
Yes. Although I would argue that perhaps costs are being kept down unnaturally and at some expense to, you know, student success and delivery of programs. But that's another issue.
Yeah. Okay. Should we go on? That's Oregon State. You can have that discussion. But I want to put this here because this is based on a tuition of $3,600 at Green River Community College. That's about the tuition at Portland Community Colleges. And there are right now about 1,700 students that get free tuition at Green River Community College. If you converted that group to pay it forward, then and the graduates from this cohort pay into Pay It Forward, allowing a new accretion, then you can see this tremendous growth in the number of students who are participating in Pay It Forward, greater than the current FTEs over time at Green River Community College. And I want to put this slide up because this shows you the importance of actually also addressing, I think this question came up, addressing the tuition levels themselves. Because if you have this accretion model, if you have lower tuition, let's say the top tuition I have is 2,000, the bottom line is 3,600. 3,600 is the bottom line. You can see that the accretion rate is very slow. But if you return to your tuition of 2001, which was $2,000, you can see the accretion line is quite fast, and we can bring in many more students. And with states like Oregon and Washington, where we have tremendous population growth, and we have a tremendous need for students getting higher education, we want a system that's going to be able to accrete more and more students faster and faster over time. Very briefly, we're partnering with other states, Pennsylvania, New York, Vermont, Oregon, California, in trying to develop the different iterations of this model. We're consulting with stakeholders and legislators. We're actually figuring out how to start pilot programs. We're working with an economist from Gibson Economics in Seattle. We're developing actuarial calculations. We've developed an interactive spreadsheet where you can change relevant factors like the number of years to contribute, the percent of income to contribute, and the tuition rate, and you can see what that does in terms of cash flow and when you get to positive cash flow. We're working with the U.S. Treasury and with other states, especially Oregon, about their efforts. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for that presentation, Spurbank. That really helps, I think, to clarify what this program is all about. And unfortunately, we don't have much time left, so if the two of you could be very, very quick in your comments, that would be great.
Chair Dembro, members of the committee, I will try to be very brief. For the record, my name is Jason Gettle. I'm a policy analyst with the Oregon Center for Public Policy. And since you've already heard some details of the program and from the student perspective, I'll just concentrate on some work that we did at OCPP to try to build on John's analysis to apply the program to Oregon, and so running some Oregon-specific numbers. We relied on enrollment levels and average tuition within the Oregon University system. And we also relied on the share of total education expenses contributed by the student and the total share put forth by the state for the 2009-10 academic year. And like John did, we relied on the value of a college degree over the last generation. And what we found in our analysis is that on average, if each student were to pay 3% of her income into the Pay It Forward program after completing her education, after about 20 years, she would cover the cost of her own educational expenses for that four-year degree. Therefore, after that, the program would begin to run a yearly surplus. And again, on average, after about 24 years of repayment, she would contribute about $7,400 beyond her own educational expenses into this fund that would go towards covering the education expenses of subsequent students. One of the biggest questions that I had in putting this analysis together was something that has come up here several times, and that's the how to factor in the rising costs of education, especially in the context of skyrocketing tuition. And looking at the latest OUS Factbook, we can see that it's not the total education expenses that have gone up. They've remained remarkably steady after we factor into inflation only going up about 12% in inflation-adjusted terms from 89-90 to the 11-12 academic year. But it's the cost shifting from the state onto the student over that time period that has accounted for the increased tuition and fees, which have nearly tripled over that same time period. This analysis would, of course, need to be updated and adjusted to match any type of pilot program that is eventually phased in. But I think it does provide a decent first cut, a rough estimate as to how this program can be sustainable over the long term. In closing, I just wanted to say that this type of program might not completely alleviate the problems of education inequality. We still need to address the cost issue as well as increasing public investment in higher education and addressing inequities that students face before getting to college. But as John mentioned, I think it can eliminate a daunting barrier that many students face and that keeps many students out of the higher education system. And namely, that's the eye-popping upfront educational costs. So thank you very much for your time, and thank you for taking the time to consider this issue. It's very important, and I commend you for trying to tackle it.
Thank you, Ms. Gale. Dr. King.
Thank you, Chair Dembrough, Vice Chairs Harker and Huffman, members of the committee. I really appreciate the chance to testify in front of you today on such a key issue. We feel it so strongly at the universities. I'm Mary King. I'm a professor of economics at Portland State. I've given you this written testimony, so I'll try to be very brief and save a few minutes if we have them for questions, because it is a new concept here that we're talking about. But I wanted to talk to you from three perspectives. The first is as a labor economist about the numbers. If you've seen any of the numbers that underpin the estimates that my colleagues have provided, I struggled with those myself the first time I saw them. You cannot help but struggle and think, is this the right analysis? Is this a correct estimate of future costs and revenues? And what would be better? And I worked myself all the way around to thinking, this is our best first approximation. This is the most solid kind of analysis we can do. It's based on the past 20 years of experience. Now, the next 20 years are not going to be the same as the past 20 years, but we've experienced a lot of change in the past 20 years, and we don't know what the heck is going to happen in the next 20 years. We know many things will stay the same. We're going to need people to work in education. We're going to need people to work in health, transportation, retail. A lot of our industries will stay, but we're dealing with technological change, globalization, all these kinds of things, and the future is so obscure to us that I started to think, we can't make a reasonable forecast that doesn't just create noise and junk. We are better off just saying, what the heck has happened in the last 20 years? Things have changed, and let us base our analysis there. And that's what we do in this state for our economic forecast. It's what we do for our prison population. It's what we do for, should we build this stinking bridge over the Columbia? You know, it's all about what is the recent experience, because we've been dealing with these issues. So I came around to thinking, you know what, this was the right analysis. We have our best evidence of what's going on with the occupational structure, the wage structure, the role of education by looking at the recent past. And there's just no doubt that if we put something into place like this, we'll have to monitor it. We're not going to be able to go, cool, the numbers are done, let's go to lunch, you know, for the next 20 years. We'll have to monitor it, adjust, and see how things go. But we cannot, I'm very comfortable. So I wanted to say that to you as an economist. I'm very comfortable with the numbers that my colleagues have created, and I would have done the same thing. And I think they hit at the real question, the real crisis, which we feel so strongly on the universities, which is this shift to the students of the cost. We have to arrest this. And so the other two perspectives I wanted to come to you with, really three, I'm a parent as well, but the other two are, I'm the president of the full-time faculty union at Portland State, the PSU AAUP, and I'm an educator, and I see my students so burdened with debt. They're working so hard. The students you see present, they're so impressive, and yet they're working full-time, so many of them, and they're going to school full-time, and you cannot
do what justice to your college education that way. It's wrong. Those of us who are middle-aged had a very subsidized public education, and we benefited this country because of it. You can see the impact on the economy from those public investments. We have to get back there. The state has to continue to keep in mind the public benefits of higher education, but we also have to take this burden off our students. It's just wrong. It's unconscionable. It's slowing down. We're never getting to 40-40-20 if we don't change something. And I think this has a real chance of changing the student debt crisis. We can't wait for leadership on the federal level. That's clear. We have a chance to do something in the state, and I really encourage you to do it. I think we've got time to study it, and I really appreciate the fact that you've taken this on.
Thank you very much, Mary. Okay. Thank you, panel. I know you have questions, but I just want to, is Salvaggio still here? Oh, okay. Yes, I'm going to dismiss this panel, please, and just get a response from the Treasury. We have Diet Walid has signed up, and she's come from over 100 miles. So I'd like to call you up to comment if Diet is still here. Thank you. Yeah, lunch.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Michael Burdick with the State Treasurer's Office, pinch-hitting from Mike Salvaggio today. Just wanted to read a quick statement from the Treasurer's Office on this. So as the committee knows, the Treasurer is concerned about the issues of access and affordability to post-secondary education. The issues have a broad array of policy implications. The Treasurer believes that maintaining a well-educated workforce is a goal that yields benefits not just to the individual students in terms of enrichment and then the higher taxes that they end up paying themselves, but also the putting less pressure on safety net services and public services, better health outcomes, higher per capita incomes. It's good for the state. The devil is, of course, in the details, and this session you will all be seeing a number of plans around higher education governance, student aid, cost controls. One of them was the Treasurer's Opportunity Initiative, which you heard recently, and we just wanted to point out that this plan, the Pay It Forward plan, is obviously a very intriguing plan. From our perspective, it's certainly compatible with the Opportunity Initiative. Neither depends on the other. One could work without the other. Just to reiterate, the Opportunity Initiative, with the opportunity, we were trying to create a revenue stream that could be deployed through or into this sort of plan. Just to sum up, it's an intriguing proposal. It could utilize the revenue stream from the Opportunity Initiative, or the Opportunity Initiative could supplement it. We'd like to see more about this.
Thank you, Michael. And please convey our thanks to the Treasurer.
Thank you.
Yes, yeah, please.
Thank you for putting me on your schedule.
Yes, thank you. Thanks for coming all this way.
Chair Denbrough, Vice Chairs Huffman and Harker, my name is Diet Walid, and I'm here today to give you some personal interest stories on this issue. You've heard from students. I want to tell you more from the personal aspect of from those students and friends who are now suffering from student debt and why there's such a huge need for this proposal. I'm an adjunct professor at Portland State University. My students are mostly seniors getting ready to graduate and living in fear, as you've heard, about tens of thousands of dollars in debt and not being able to get jobs in order to repay it. Two of my daughters are in their 40s, and two granddaughters in their 20s are all students in public education, higher education in Oregon, struggling to get an education to support their families at the same time. Student debt has at least two generations of our children in its grip and won't let go. A friend of mine graduated with a bachelor's degree after the age of 50. She works in alcohol and drug treatment. The only way she will ever make more or get advancement in her field is to go back to school for a master's, but she has such a huge problem with student debt now that that's simply not an option. So just a few years after graduation, she has reached the ceiling of her employment advancement because of student debt. When this friend started paying back on her loans, no one had explained to her that she had separate loans from separate creditors. She thought that her payments of up to $465 a month were covering the payments due. They weren't. After about 3 months, she figured out the problem through the help of the Federal Education Ombudsman, but already the creditors were phoning her as many as three times a day with robocalls. Even after the ombudsman helped settle the situation, the calls continued. They kept alleging past due amounts as little as $60, but escalating to the hundreds that they had added to her debt. The banks add fines and late fees and continually increase what they say is owed, and the borrower has no way to contest these charges. Each time she refused to return the robocall, she was reported to the credit reporting bureaus as delinquent. Her credit has been destroyed. She states that the collectors for student loans are worse than the loan sharks because they have the power to add fees that the students haven't agreed to, and they have no way of they don't have to explain themselves. My daughters and granddaughters are still struggling to get degrees, but when they graduate, they will have tens of thousands of dollars of debt and very few jobs available. The banks who own their loans have the right to escalate the interest rates and compound the interest. Even if they are allowed to postpone this payment on their loans, the interest continues to escalate and compound even before they can begin to make payments. Many graduates have found that they owe four or five times the amounts that they have borrowed. The whole problem of student debt is escalating exponentially. Students can't get professional-level jobs because of the bad economy. The cost of education jumps every year, leading to more reliance on loans. Colleges and universities give out loans without explaining to the students the consequences. Students are caught in the middle. I won't go into my tales of the good old days, but just say that you've heard the information already on how much the student debt burden has been shifted to the students. This bill would be a great gift to give to our children and grandchildren, as well as increasing the economy, as you've heard earlier. It would allow them to complete their educations debt-free and begin contributing to the economy. It would be a boost to Oregon's economy. All the money that now goes into the pockets of Wall Street banksters could flow into the economy of Oregon. Students and their families, including many of us, need you to take a close look at the whole industry of student debt and see how much need there is for this proposal. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Ms. Waleed. And thank you both for testifying. Everyone who came today, I know there are some of you who were scheduled to speak or signed up to speak. We don't have time to do that. But we will, you know, as we work on this bill to get it ready to move on, we will have another public hearing on it, and so you'll have a chance for further testimony. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2838. And colleagues, yes, Rep. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, when will we hear from the education providers, OUS, and community colleges?
At the right time.
Thank you,
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. When we have time, sir. We are adjourned.